You'll probably blow my concentration. I'll forget where I am. No. Now we just go through the whole thing, and that way I can't lie to you, because if I just skipped around here a little, there a little, and didn't take the whole thing, then I could horribly twist it, and you'd think that I could lead you astray. But if I go through the whole thing, it's pretty tough, because God lined it up in that order. We might as well read it that way. Sunday mornings, we've been going through the book of Mark. Sunday nights, we just finished 2 Thessalonians. We're going into 1 Timothy. Thursday nights, we're whipping through the book of Leviticus. And today we left off in Mark chapter 14. And where we are, this is after, this is fast approaching the crucifixion. We've had the Last Supper. Jesus has given them the bread and the wine, explained this was a new covenant. Gone off to Gethsemane. Well, last week we talked about Gethsemane. It is a garden. It means olive press. And certainly it's where Jesus was pressed. Let's back up just a little bit. Say around verse 32 of Mark chapter 14. It says this: "And they came to a place which was named Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, Sit ye here while I shall pray. And he taketh with him Peter, James, and John, and began to be sore amazed and very heavy, and saith unto them, My soul is exceeding sorrowful unto death. Tarry ye here and watch. And he went forward a little, and fell on the ground, and prayed, that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible unto thee. Take away this cup from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what thou wilt. And he goes, and this is the hour, and we talked about this a little last week, about him settling everything. This is where the real trial is. And he takes Peter, James, and John a little closer. This is, again, written by John Mark, who was a disciple of Peter. And so many regard this as sort of Peter's account of the gospel. And so apparently bringing Peter, James, and John a little closer and then going off to pray by himself, asking them to just watch while he prays. And they hear him praying, and they hear him saying, Abba, Father. And Abba just being the Hebrew word for daddy. And Jesus talking to his dad and saying, Dad, if there's any other way, take away this cup from me. And the idea I want to talk about a little bit is just the cup, first of all, what he was talking about. You know, let this cup pass. And you think, well, what, communion? He just did that. You know, I don't get it. Now, Psalm 75, verse 7 says this, and I'll read it. You don't have to jump if you don't want. But Psalm 75, verse 7 says, But God is the judge. He putteth down one, and he setteth up another. For in the hand of the Lord there is a cup, and the wine is red. It is full of mixture, and he poureth out the same. But the dregs thereof, all of the wicked of the earth, shall wring them out and drink them. And speaking of the same idea in Revelation chapter 14, verse 10, talks about this cup some more, this cup of wine of the Lord. And it says, The same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels, and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest, day or night, who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. And the idea is the cup of wrath. The Lord is a righteous God. He's a holy God. And the law has been established that said, Thou shalt not. You're familiar with the Ten Commandments. You shall not take the Lord thy God's name in vain. You shall not bear false witness, lie. You shall not steal, commit adultery, all of those things. And of course, Jesus refined that to the list of saying, no, you're not getting it. It's not about committing the action. It's about the heart. Because if you think that you've never killed anybody, but you hate everybody, all you've lacked is opportunity. The motive is there, and you're as guilty of that commandment as if you had killed someone. And the Lord's a really holy, righteous God. And because of that, he has to deal with transgression, with sin. And of course, we don't want that for ourselves. We always want that for somebody else. Alan was telling me the other day about a news article he read. Grandmother, 70-year-old. Alan's kind of into guns, and there was, I think she's a 70-plus-year-old woman. I think it was in Texas, maybe I'm paraphrasing it. But she gets up and she sees a set of footprints in her house, and they lead in through the door, and they go through the house, and they go right into a closet and stop, and there's no footprints coming back out. And she's thinking, I didn't remember coming in here with money boots, you know. And so she opens up the closet door, and there's a guy in her closet, and he jumps out at her. And it just so happens she's packing a Roscoe that's just like, she's got the Dirty Harry model, the big Colt, you know. And she pulls it out, boom, boom, and she puts like 3-4 in the guy's head, you know, kills him dead on the spot. And come to find out, he was a guy who had been wanted for raping the elderly. And you think, yeah, baby, that's right. You go to Dirty Grammy, you know, and she takes care of business. And you hear that and you think, yeah, man, he got what he deserved. That's awesome. Forget the court system. You know, he got. And it's real easy for us to say, yeah, that's right. That's justice. That's what's deserved. But it's a little more difficult when you start looking at yourself and thinking about what you deserve, because, you know, what the Lord says is, you know, Romans 3:23, the wages of sin is death. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, Romans 3:23. Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death. When you break God's law, you're guilty and you have to be punished. And if he was any less than a righteous judge, he could let you off, but he's not. And the truth is, if somebody offends you and you take them to court, if somebody steals from you and you take them to court, you go to the judge and he just says, oh, you know, he took from you, but you know what, he's okay. I mean, he... It's all right. We'll just forget the whole thing. You'd be saying, no. We're not forgetting the whole thing. He ripped me off. He took my stuff. I want it back. And if that judge let him go with nothing happening, you'd be screaming up and down that he's a crooked judge. Well, the Lord isn't a crooked judge, which means he's got to punish when we break the law. That's the way it is. But in that punishment is this cup of wrath of God. And it says it's poured out without mixture. You know, when they made wine in Jesus' time, they would make it in big vats, and of course it would ferment, and they wouldn't necessarily drink it full strength, especially, you know, the water there was kind of nasty. There was, you know, parasites and things in the water, so they would mix that with wine, and the alcohol in the wine would kill off the parasites, so stuff was good to drink. I mean, certainly they drank and got drunk. I'm not saying they didn't, but what I'm saying is frequently when they did wine, they would mix it with water to lighten it up because it was too strong when it came out of the vat. In talking about the cup of God's wrath, it says in Revelation, it's poured without mixture. There's no mixing. It's full strength. When you take a drink, you got to drink it all. And it talks in back in Psalms that when I read about the dregs, and you know what the dregs is? The dregs is the little bit of leftover in the bottom of the cup, you know, every last little sip. And when you drink of the Lord's judgment, you're going to get it all. There's no, you know, I'm just going to take a little sip and then I'm fine. Once you start drinking that cup, you're all the way to the bottom. And unfortunately, like it says in Revelation, the part I read, that wrath, that torment, it's forever and ever. No rest, day or night. You know, Jesus talked a lot about hell, and he talked about it not in a ha-ha, you're going to hell, but in a, man, that's a bad place, and you don't want to go, and you want to do anything in your power to avoid it. Man, if your eye is causing you to sin and send you to hell, rip it out and chuck it. If your hand is bugging you, cut it off and throw it from you, because this is a bad place, and whatever is dragging you there, you need to get rid of. And that is the cup. Well, in order for the Lord to forgive us, somebody had to pay. And it had to be somebody who didn't have to pay for his own. See, I couldn't pay for your sins because I got too many of my own. Even if I got one, I got too many, but I have my own. And so if I got a drink of the cup, I got to drink my own, which is eternal. And so instead, he sends his son. And this is the cup that Jesus says, Lord, if there's any other way, please let it pass from me. You know, I don't want to drink of this. And it wasn't the physical, although the physical was bad, the punishment that he took. But it was after the physical beating, being on the cross, and then having your sins and my sins and everybody else's sins laid on him. And you think about that. When Jesus was on the cross, it says he died for the sins of the whole world. Now, not everybody's going to take advantage of that payment, but that means every Adolf Hitler, every Uday and Kusei Hussein, every child molester, every vile, wicked sin that ever was put on him. And at that point, that's when he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? And the father turned away because he couldn't look on his son. And, you know, every place else, Jesus talks of my father, that's the only place he says, my God. He doesn't call him dad because there was a separation because our sin was laid on him. And that's what he's asking. Can this please pass by me? And that's where the battle was, you know. And this this idea was not an afterthought. Here we started in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. If you're familiar with the fall, Adam and Eve, they sinned. God said, you can have everything in the garden. There's one tree. Don't eat of that tree. That's it. Just one tree. You got all the rest you can have. Just stay away from that one. And but they're like us, and they go for the one they can't have. Or just like the kids, you could say, don't stand on the couch, and you know they're going to stand on the couch. You say, keep off the grass, you know people are going to walk on the grass. That's wet paint. You got to touch it and see if it's really wet or if it's dried already. You can't help it. There's something in us because we're sinful people. And Adam and Eve, they fell. They tried to cover themselves up with leaves because they realized they were naked. It was the institution of religion, by the way, back there in Genesis chapter 2, where they cover themselves with leaves, trying to do their own stuff to cover them. And God comes along and says, what'd you do? What'd you do? And then in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, he talks to Eve, and he says, and well, he's talking to the snake, actually, the serpent, Satan, and he says in 3:15, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, thou shalt bruise his heel. And it talks about the seed of the woman. Now, you don't have to go very far in biology class to realize, wait a minute, the woman doesn't carry the seed, the man does. What's the deal, the seed of a woman? In Isaiah, the prophet mentioned it a little bit in Isaiah chapter 7. He said, therefore the Lord himself, we're approaching Christmas, you're familiar with this verse, the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son. Shall call his name Emmanuel. Talking about one person, the seed of the woman, who would be born of a woman, no earthly father, so he didn't inherit sin. Instead, he had God was his father, and he came without original sin, without inherited sin. And from the very beginning that he was prophesied of, he was one who would come. But later on in Genesis chapter 22, you remember Abraham and Isaac, and the Lord had told him that his descendants would all come through Isaac. And then he says to him, I want you to go sacrifice your son to me. And Abraham, acting out prophecy, goes to Mount Moriah, which incidentally is also Golgotha, the same place. And he takes his son up on top, and he brings the wood for a sacrifice. He tells the people down below, wait here, we'll be back, he and I. And he takes him to the top of the mountain, and Isaac, his son, who, by the way, is probably about 30 years old, he's not a little kid, and he's going, Dad, we got wood, you know, we got fire, where's the sacrifice? And in Genesis chapter 22, verse 8, Abraham says a very interesting thing to his son. He says in Genesis 22, 8, Abraham said, my son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went, both of them together. And he said, he didn't say God will provide for himself a lamb. He'll come up with a lamb, don't worry about it. He said God will provide himself a lamb, that God himself will be the lamb for a burnt offering. And even from back then, there was this pointing towards a sacrifice that would come. You know, and the verse that, the section that really blows me away is in Isaiah 53. And if you're familiar with that chapter of Isaiah, it's a great one, and it's prophetic. It speaks of Jesus who would come and his suffering. And in Isaiah 53, verse 10, is a kind of a hard to understand verse, at least to me. It says, yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief when thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin. He shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. And it actually pleased the Lord to bruise his son for our sakes. You know, Jesus, when he prayed, said, Lord, if there's any other way, let this cup pass from me. And the answer was, of course, Jesus said, not my will, but your will be done. And the fact that Jesus went to the cross means, no, there is no other way. It has to be you. It has to be a perfect sacrifice. And in order to have a relationship with you, in order to have a relationship with me, Jesus had to die. The Lord had to send his son to die in our place. And to think, I mean, I love my kids. I like you guys, but I'll be honest with you. I'm not going to kill my kids for you. It's not going to happen because I love my children. And the fact that God the Father would do that to his son blows me away. And so this is what Jesus was struggling with. This is to the point, it tells us in the other gospel accounts, that he was struggling so much with this, what he was going to have to go through, that he started sweating drops of blood, hematidrosis, where the strain causes the blood vessels to pop, and he's just bleeding just with the struggle and the strain. Then he comes back in verse 37, back in Mark 14. He says he finds them sleeping. He says unto Peter, Simon, sleepest thou? Couldst thou not watch 1 hour? And, of course, we had talked last week about how Peter had said, hey, if everybody else leaves you, I'm ready to die for you. And now, just a while later, he is asleep. And Jesus said, watch and pray in verse 38, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit truly is ready, but the flesh is weak. And again he went away, and he prayed and spake the same words. And when he returned, he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. Neither wished they what to answer him. And he cometh the third time and saith unto them, sleep on now, and take your rest. It is enough. The hour is come. Behold, the Son of Man is betrayed in the hands of sinners. And that's where we ended last week with, it is enough. It is settled. And at that point, the struggle was over. From here, he's a man on a mission. He's not, there's no doubt, and he is going to be crucified, and he has caused all of this to come into motion, and he manages the trial. He goes through every little detail, his meeting with Pilate, everything, because he was going to die for you and I. And it says, the hour has come, behold, the Son of Man is betrayed in the hands of sinners. And then he said in verse 42, rise up, let us go. He that betrayeth me is at hand. In verse 43, it says, and immediately while he yet spake, cometh Judas, one of the 12, and with him a great multitude with swords and staves from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. And he that betrayed him had given them a token, saying, whomsoever I shall kiss, that same is he, take him and lead him away safely. And as soon as he was come, he goeth straightway to him and said, Master, Master, and kissed him. And so Judas shows up, it says, with a great multitude. It's, the idea is about like a cohort, which means there's at least probably 600 guys. This is not a small group. They come and they've got swords and they've got sticks and they've got torches. It's the middle of the night. They come into the garden. And Judas said to them, look, I'll point him out to you, because, you know, we always think of Jesus as the paintings we see, the glowing head and floating a foot off the ground. And that's not the case. You know, he looked like everybody else. Bible tells us there's nothing about his outward appearance that we should desire him. And so Judas said, this is how you know who you're supposed to grab. I'll go up and I'll kiss him. And where it says he kissed him, it doesn't mean he just went up and put a little peck on his cheek. It means he was just smothering his face with kisses to point him out. Interesting, he says, you know, Master, Master. And then he kisses him. And how many people do that today that are truly enemies of Christ, but yet, oh, he's a great teacher? Because the master means teacher, rabbi. You know, oh, just, he's a great teacher. You know, he was really a good person. But yet, they betray who he truly is, which was God. And, you know, Jesus himself said in Matthew chapter 7, verse 22, many will come to me in that day saying, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? Have we not cast out devils in thy name, done many powerful works? He says, and then I will profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you that work iniquity. And here's Judas, who was with Jesus for 3+ years, who was the place of honor at the feast, had been carrying the money bag, had been given, when he sent out his 12 disciples, he'd been given the power, excuse me, to just heal whoever he wanted, to raise the dead, to heal the sick, everything. And yet he never knew him. He didn't understand who it was that he was with, and he owned all that. And you know, how many people do you know that have grown up in a Christian family, or they've grown up going to church, and yet they wouldn't know God if God ran up and bit them on the leg? I mean, they just have no clue about what it's all about. I go in, I do my time, you know, I spend 45 minutes, an hour a week, sometimes an hour and 15 minutes, you know, I can't believe it, but I do this great sacrifice where I go in there and he says blah, 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 and I look at the ceiling and read the posters on the wall, and then I go home and I've done my time and, you know, that's it. And yet, that's not knowing him. It's all about knowing him. It's not about doing things to earn his favor. It's not about putting in your dues, spending time in church prison, you know, once a week. It's none of that. It's about knowing him. And unfortunately, it's possible to go and be as close as Judas and never, ever know him. You know, and they all come, and it's really interesting when you read the various accounts, because you've got all these people show up with the torches and the sticks, and because they're expecting some sort of rebellion. They want to make sure this is done with no chance of anybody fighting it. And, of course, Jesus doesn't fight it. He's expecting it. He started it all. He was the one who told Judas, because the priest, you remember, the priest had said, hey, we don't want to do this on the feast day. It's coming up to Passover. Make sure it doesn't happen on the feast day. Then they get into Passover, and Jesus says, somebody's going to betray me. And Judas says, is it I? And he says, you said it. You know, ain't you got some place you're supposed to be? And so Judas goes out. He initiates the whole thing, so Judas has to do it then, and he has to be taken on this day. Now, when you read the Gospel of John, when they all come into the garden, and, you know, it says that Jesus goes right up to him, and they, and says, and he initiates, he goes to the whole crowd with the soldiers, and he says, who are you looking for? Whom seek ye? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And if you read it, it says, I am he, only if you read it in the King James, the he is in italics, which means it was added in by the Bible translators just to try to make it sound better in English. But the truth is, he said, I am. And I am, if you remember your Old Testament, we went through Genesis, when Moses was in the desert and he sees that burning bush, and he goes up to it, and the Lord speaks to him out of that bush, and the Lord tells him he's going to go and deliver his people, and Moses says, I can't, I stumble in my speech, I won't be able to do it. And he says, well, I'll go there, and they'll say, who sent you, and who do I say? I don't even know your name, and what do I say? And the Lord said, I am. I am that I am, because he's the only one, and he doesn't, that I am, not I was, not I will be, not, you know, but I am, just eternal. And that is the name that God identified him with, so much so that the Jews would never say that word. They wouldn't pronounce the name of God, and they wouldn't even say I am, because they didn't want to confuse it with that. And there are several instances where Jesus is talking, like when he's talking with the Pharisees, and he's talking about Abraham, and he says, before Abraham was, I am. And the religious leaders, thankfully, help us underline our Bible, because whenever you see them reach down and pick up rocks, it's an indication that Jesus has just claimed to be God. And by saying, I am, he's identifying with the voice in the burning bush, and he's identifying himself as God. And here, it says, then John, the soldiers come up to him and say, whom seek you? And they say, Jesus of Nazareth. And he says, I am. And when he says, I am, boom, they all fall down. It says all 600 guys fall down. And when 600 guys in the dark fall down with swords and torches, it's not a, you know, it's like, ah, you know, people are on fire, the people are rolling around, it's a crazy mess. And they stand back up again, and Jesus says, now, whom seek you? And guaranteed, the whole tone changes, and instead of Jesus of Nazareth, it's Jesus of Nazareth? And he said, I told you I am. And he could have played this all day. You know, he could have said, I am. They go down, they get up. Who are you thinking of? Jesus, I am. Boom, down, they go down. But so now they're all like, kind of, well, Jesus of Nazareth. And he says, I told you I am. Let these go. And at that point, he did that thing, and he knocked them all down, because you'll notice none of the disciples get taken here. They're all allowed to go. They would have arrested them all, killed them all, closed the whole thing down. But Jesus said, no, you let them go. You're looking for me, take me. And of course, if you've just been blown over 600 guys by one guy saying, I am, you'll say, that's okay. If you'll come, we'll do whatever you want, you know. And so that's where they are. It said in verse 46 here in Mark 14, they laid their hands on him and took him. And one of them that stood by drew a sword and smote a servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. Now, Mark doesn't name him. And there's a couple places where Mark doesn't name who it is. Like, he doesn't, when we went through the thing with Mary where she broke the ointment on him, he doesn't name her as Mary. He just says a certain woman. And Mark is one of the earlier Gospels. Many people think because they were still alive at the time this was written, rather than implicate them because there was some pressure on the Christians at that time, he just said certain people. John, later on, writes his much after, when those people would have been dead, and he says it was Peter who cut off this guy's ears. He said it was Mary that broke the box of ointment. And so Peter, Mark's the guy that he kind of followed around afterwards, he was a disciple of, he sees everybody get knocked over, and he thinks, this is it, me and the Lord, baby, let's go. You know, and he's got a sword somewhere between the Last Supper, because Jesus had said in another one of the Gospels, you know, before I sent you out without anything, now make sure you have a sword. And so Peter apparently took that to heart. He doesn't listen to most of the other things, but he thinks, I got to have me a sword. So he gets one somewhere in the dark on the way to the garden. And so he sees everybody knocked over, and he thinks, me and Jesus, this is going to be like Gideon. I'm ready, baby. This is my thing. And he comes off with a sword, and, whoa, you know, and the best he can manage to do is hack some dude's ear off. And it's not even one of the soldiers. It's somebody's servant. You know, so now there's a guy sitting there with no ear, and Jesus says, Peter, just, no, put away your sword, you know. And interesting, Luke, who wrote the Gospel of Luke, was a doctor, the doctor Luke, and he's the one that tells us, in the middle of all this, Jesus stops, and it says, touches this guy's ear and heals it. Now, I always look at that, and I have to ask myself, because it says he touches the ear and heals it. Does that mean Peter cuts his ear off, so there's an ear laying in the dirt, in the grass, in the garden, and then Jesus touches it? Does Jesus pick up the ear and blow off the grass and put it back on his head? Does he touch him on the head and a new one grows out and the old one's still laying? You know, and even beyond that, you know what happens when somebody cuts your ear off? We were watching, last night was the ultimate UFC pay-per-view thing, and Alan and I were watching it late. And one of the guys gets hit in the nose and it demolishes his nose. And so from the point of when that guy hit him to the time when his back end hits the floor from falling over backwards, he's just covered. It just explodes all over his face, you know. And, you know, stuff around your head bleeds. You know how that works. And so this guy, to have his ear cut off, you know, he's got to have blood all over him. And then Jesus heals him. And his ear's back. Yet he's covered in blood. There may even be half an ear laying on the ground there. And so of those 600, you know, there's one guy who's a convert now. We have a new follower of Jesus at this point, because I'm put his ear back on. So anyways, Peter thinks this is the time, and he jumps out, and Jesus says, no, you don't understand. Now put away your sword. And so in verse 48, you know, they all run away. Jesus answered and said unto them, Are you come out as against a thief with swords and with staves to take me? I was daily with you in the temple teaching, and you took me not. But the scriptures must be fulfilled. Again, speaking of one who must come. This is the way it's going to be. And in verse 50 it says, They all forsook him and fled. Now Mark, most people think these next two verses apply to Mark, the writer of this gospel. I don't know. Personally, if this was me writing it and I was going to put in a little bit about myself, I don't know if this is what I'd put in, but it says, There followed him a certain young man having a linen cloth cast about his naked body, and the young men laid hold on him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. And so here's Mark. He's a young guy with them, and all the disciples take off, and Mark's saying, I was there, and somebody grabbed me, and I just left my shirt and went running naked away. I mean, that's his biography. But then again, it also would let you know that he was probably the last one there. He stuck till the final end until they tried to grab him. And so in verse 53, it says, They led Jesus away to the high priest. And with him were assembled all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes. And they take him to Caiaphas' house. Now, if you actually read the chronology from the various gospels, they take him to Annas first. Annas used to be the high priest. And then he was high priest for a series of years, and then he left being high priest. Rome wanted their own appointees as the high priest, so Annas' son became the high priest. And then after Annas' son, Caiaphas takes over as high priest. Caiaphas is Annas' son-in-law. So they go to Annas, then they send to Caiaphas. This is at Caiaphas, and they assemble the council, the religious leaders, the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court of Israel. Now, everything about this is illegal, okay? It's the middle of the night. Their own rules said they could not have a trial at night. Later on, we're going to see they're going to put him to death. Their own rules said if somebody was to receive the death sentence, they would give it and then they would go away for a day, 24 hours, where they'd have a chance to think about it and pray about it and then come back together again and make sure they really want to do this thing because it was a heavy deal. None of that happens. This is a crazy trial from the beginning. And so they haul him off to Caiaphas. And it says in verse 54, And Peter followed him afar off, even into the palace of the high priest, and he sat with the servants, and he warmed himself at the fire. Now, there's a great object lesson in if you follow Peter through this whole last couple weeks of what he does, because it starts out with Jesus saying, you know, you guys are all going to forsake me, and then Peter starts boasting, and he says, oh, no, I'll never leave you. You know, and of course, Corinthians tells us, beware when you think you stand, lest you fall. And Peter, oh yeah, no, Lord, if everybody else goes, hey, I'm with you, me and you, I can die for you. And I think he meant it, but here he is boasting about how strong he is. Well, the next time you see Peter, he's in the garden, and what's he doing? He's asleep. Jesus says, just stay awake for an hour, I'm going to go pray. And he falls asleep. And you know, that's where we get, first of all, we start boasting on how strong we are as believers, or how great our walk is, and the next thing you know, we're sleeping when we should be praying. And you know how easy that is for us to do. You sit down, great intentions, I'm just going to read, you know, and there you are, you're Bob, and you're doing the Bob and drool, and you can't stay awake. And here's Peter, he starts out boasting, next thing you know, he's sleeping when he should be praying. Then when he finally gets his chance, he hacks off an ear, and of course, with us, I mean, our sword, the word is the sword of the Spirit, you know, and if you're busy bragging about how much you know, and then you're busy sleeping when you should be praying, when you actually draw your sword, you're not going to be, I mean, the sword is to convict people, to divide between that which is soulless and spiritual, it tells us in Hebrews. And the best we're going to do is just hack somebody's ear off. We're going to be smacking them with the word because we're using it inappropriately, and we're going to be attacking instead of trying to win them. We're going to try to beat them. You know, and then you see him here in verse 54, what is he doing? He's following Jesus afar off. That is the worst place to be as a believer, because we talked about this last week. The ones who follow afar, you know, when the lion goes after the herd of gazelles, it's the one slow one in the back that he always takes down, and you see hanging out of his mouth going up a tree. In the same way, when we follow Jesus afar off, when we want, you know, some sort of semblance of relationship with him, but we don't want to get too close because we know what happens. Everybody who comes to Jesus doesn't leave the same. They go to him, and he says, go and sin no more. And he changes you. But yet we like the stuff that we don't want to give to him, that he says, go and don't do anymore. So we'll stay far enough away that he doesn't talk to us. We'll just be able to see him. And that's where Peter is. And next thing you know, he's following him, but he's way off. And we'll see at the end of verse 54, what's he doing? He's warming himself at the fire in the courtyard with the enemies of Christ. And see, that's what happens as this distance separates. When you stop spending time with the Lord, when you get far away from him, next thing you know, instead of being next to Christ, you're over at the enemy's camp and you're at his fire and you're warming yourself up and you're in a place you shouldn't be. You know, you're fellowshipping with people you shouldn't be fellowshipping with because they're going to lead you to a place you don't want to go. And of course, the fruition of this we're going to see in a couple of verses is you end up like Peter, denying Christ. And that's the progression. And, you know, you'll find yourself there. As a believer, I found myself there. And the thing to do is realize it wasn't that I wasn't strong enough to keep from denying Christ. It was way back when I was supposed to be humble, I was boasting. When I was supposed to be praying, I was sleeping. And when I was supposed to be close to him, I was far off. It's a series of events, and they lead like dominoes. And so here's Peter warming himself at the enemy's fire. Verse 55, and the chief priests and the council sought for witnesses against Jesus to put him to death, and they found none. Can't find anything wrong with him. For many bear false witness against him, but their witnesses agreed not together. And, you know, everybody's making stuff up, trying to convict him. And there arose certain and bear false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. But neither so did their witness agree. And there was one place where they were asking Jesus for a sign early on, and he said, they're not going to get a sign. Here's a sign for you. Destroy this temple, and it tells us right in the text, he was talking about his body. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will rise it up again. Well, these guys were saying, he's a terrorist. He's threatening to, you know, destroy the temple. And of course, we've already talked, the stones on the base of that temple, some of them were 400 plus tons. There's no, you know, nuclear weapons at this point. There's no dirty bombs. He's not blowing up the temple. So that's the best they can come up with against him. And so this whole trial, it's a mockery, it's a farce. Everybody knows it's wrong. And it's interesting to think about who would be there right now. Nicodemus was a member of the religious leadership. You remember from John chapter 3, who came to him at night, and Jesus says, you must be born again, see the kingdom of God. And Joseph of Arimathea was also one of the religious leaders, member of the Sanhedrin. The two of them would be there at this trial in the middle of the night, and they would see this travesty of justice, and they would know it's not right. This is not right. And, of course, those two guys end up later on, after Jesus is crucified, it says Joseph of Arimathea is the one who goes and asks Pilate for the body and buries him in his own tomb. And Nicodemus comes and brings a 100-pound weight of burial anointing spices. And the two of them take down the body and they bury him, defiling themselves. So they were unclean for this Passover that they were supposed to be partaking in. And so those two were there. Also, Saul of Tarsus was a member of the Sanhedrin. So there's a really good chance that he was there at this. It's really interesting when you think about that. Because Paul, when you get into Acts, Paul was persecuting the church. He was on fire. He was there when Stephen got stoned. He's on fire to destroy the church. And then when the Lord finally interrupts him and knocks him down and blinds him, he says to him, Paul, Paul. And he says, who are you, Lord? And he says, it's Jesus whom you're persecuting. Isn't it hard to kick against the goads? And the goads are the thing that they would put behind the ox's legs so that he couldn't kick back, or they would jab into him, or a goad is something they would use to drive him on. And Jesus was talking about, it's just sticking you in it, Paul. Isn't it hard when that stuff is just poking you? And I think the stuff was poking him was the stuff that he, because I think he knew Jesus. I think he had been involved with Jesus throughout, and he had seen this as part of the council, and he was there at this trial, and he knew it wasn't right, but there was something inside of him that just wouldn't break. He wouldn't give in, and it wasn't until finally the Lord knocked him down on the road and blinded him that he gave in. And, you know, how many are us like that? You know, you hear about this Jesus, you hear about him, and you know, somewhere deep down inside, that's right, it's right. The way the rest of the world is treating him, it isn't right, but I know this is true, and yet you fight it, because you have an idea of what the implications are. I think that's where Saul was. And so they got no witnesses that agree. And so in verse 60 it says, the high priest stood up in the middle of them, and asked Jesus, saying, answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witnesses against thee? It says, but he held his peace and answered nothing. And he didn't even bother to respond. He said nothing. He didn't justify the charges. He just didn't even respond. Say what you want. He knew where he was going. Interesting, when he goes before the Romans, when the Jews turn him over to the Roman soldiers because the Jews don't have the authority to kill him, and he's examined with scourging, and we talked about that, how they take him out, they put the whip on his back, and it's cat of nine tails. It'll have little pieces of bone or metal or glass tied up in these thongs, and they'd lay it across the back, and then they'd snap it off. And when it did, it would shred your back. And they would talk about examining by scourging, how they would lay it on, and then they'd pull it off. And then what you were supposed to do is you were supposed to confess. Either you were supposed to confess a crime that you had done, or you were supposed to give up the name of somebody that you were involved with. And if you did, then they would lighten it, and the next time they wouldn't do it as hard. If you didn't, they'd bear down harder. And yet it says Jesus never opened his mouth. And through all of that, they shredded him to the point where his back would be laying in ribbons. You'd be able to see his ribs, his internal organs. I mean, they just tattered his back, yet he never opened his mouth. And of course, they were trying to get him to confess to a sin. He didn't have any. What's he going to say? There's nothing to say. The only sin that he was going to be punished for was yours and mine. The only names that he had to give were yours and mine. So if he was going to confess anything, it would be Steve. I'm here for Steve. And he didn't. He didn't open his mouth. He took it. And even here, he doesn't justify himself. He doesn't give an answer until verse 61. It says, again, the high priest asked him and said unto him, art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Matthew tells us the priest actually said, I adjure you by the living God. Are you the Christ? Are you the blessed? Are you the one? Are you the one who's supposed to come? Are you the one who's going to save people from their sins? Are you the one who's going to be the Redeemer of Israel? Are you the one? This one Jesus answers. And in verse 62 it says, Jesus said, I am. Again, the same as he said, ego e me, I am, identifying himself as God. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in clouds of heaven. It says, and then the high priest rent his clothes. He shreds them and says, what needeth we any further witnesses? And because that was blasphemy, to say that you were God, I am. He doesn't need to hear anything else, to claim to be the Messiah. You know, and when you... Finally, the question came down to this. Because they knew that's who he claimed to be. There was no doubt in their mind that he claimed to be the Messiah. He claimed to be God. And finally, forget all these other false witnesses about things he might have done. They ask him that one question. Are you who you say you are? Are you the one? Are you the one? And he answers that question. He says, I am. And this was, he gave them what he needed. Now, he could have said nothing and they'd had no evidence. But no, he gave it to them. And the reason why is, he will always answer that question. If you were that person struggling, is this Jesus real? Are you really who you say you are? That is a question he will always answer. And he will always say, yes, I am. I am the one. Are you the one who can save me? Yes, I am the one. He will always answer that question. And of course, that's what the high priest needed. He tears his clothes as a sign that there's been blasphemy said in his presence. And it says, and they all condemned him to be guilty of death. And look what happens to him. Some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to buffet him, and to say unto him, prophesy. And the servants did strike him with the palms of their hand. Now, they covered his face, and they started hitting him. Again, I watched, you know, we were up late last night watching that Ultimate Fighting thing. And it's interesting in that, because there are two guys fighting, and they both are well skilled at what's going on. And one guy swings, and another one blocks, or he ducks, or he, you know, and there's this whole fight thing. But every once in a while, you'll see in one of those fights, guy turns his head for a second, or the guy throws a punch from a place where he doesn't see it coming, and he just catches him flush, and it just pushes his reset button. The guy, the prime fight of the night last night, took one on the nose, and just knocked him completely unconscious, stiff as a board. He's over it. He doesn't know where he is. And see, when a punch comes, even if you're old and slow, if I was to swing at your face, you'd flinch. You have a natural built-in response to at least move in the same direction as the punch, because if you're moving in the same direction, it doesn't hit as hard. It kind of deflects some of the thing. But if you don't see one coming, you know, if you get sucker punched and somebody hits you when you have no idea it's coming, you take the full force of it. And here they are, they bag his head, they cover his face, and then they start smacking him, and they're yelling, oh yeah, prophesy, you're some great religious leader, tell us who it was who hit you. In the extent of the beating he takes, Isaiah chapter 52, verse 14 says, and many were astonished at thee. His visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. And that's the old English way of saying he was beaten beyond human recognition. And they just pummeled him, and they just beat on him. And of course, the amazing, they're spitting on him. The amazing thing is, Colossians tells us that that all things consist by him, which means everything is held together by him. And so the atoms in whatever they put over his head to cover his eyes, he was holding together. The spit that was dripping off his face, he was keeping that spit together. The hand that was punching him on the side of the face, he was allowing that person to live. In fact, the people who were laughing at him and taunting him, he was the one who gave them breath. And he allowed them. He knew them from the smallest child, and he knew all the way up through that this is going to be the guy who was going to punch me when that bag's over my head. And this is going to be the guy who's going to laugh at me and make fun of me and spit on me and beat me beyond human recognition. And yet in his mercy and in his grace, he allowed this person to live and get to that point. And that is the kind of God that we serve, one who is so graceful. You know, a lot of people say, well, there can't be a God, because if there was a God, he wouldn't allow the suffering to go on. But the truth is, if, you know, those of you who know the Lord, I mean, I remember hearing people talk about when my earliest memories of being in church when I was in, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, people talking about the Lord returning. And it always scared me back then because I didn't know him. And I think if people then who were saying, if there was really, you know, a God that loved us, he wouldn't allow this to go on anymore because it's too bad. There's people getting hurt. There's children starving to death. But the truth is, if he came back then, I'd have gone to hell because I didn't know him. You know, any of you guys who've been saved in the last 4, 5, 6, 7 years, if he'd have come back in year 2000, you'd gone to hell because you didn't know him. And it isn't out of hate, it's out of mercy, because he's not willing that any should perish, and he's patient, and he's giving time for those people to come to him. Because once he says it's too late, it's too late. That's it. And here he is allowing all this to happen to him, you know, holding the nails together that are going to hold him to the cross. Unbelievable. And it says, as Peter was beneath the palace, there cometh one of the maids of the high priest. A little servant girl comes up to him. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked upon him and said, and that also was with Jesus of Nazareth. You know, the little girl, because here's a trial going along. We caught this bad Jesus. She doesn't know what's going on. And she says, he was with them. I seen him. He's one of them. You know, and just a little girl. But he denied. Here's old Peter who said he'd die with him. He denied, saying, I know not, neither understand what you're saying. I'm just here warming. I don't know what you're talking about. And so he leaves. He went into the porch. And the cock crew, the rooster, you know, and again, you remember what Jesus said, before the rooster crows twice, you're going to deny me three times. It says, and a maid saw him again and began to say to them that stood by, that this is one of them. He's another one came by. A little girl comes by. He's one, I'm telling you. And he denied it again. And a little after, they that stood by said again to Peter, surely you're one of them, for thou art a Galilean, and the speech agreeth thereto. And, you know, he was from the section of Galilee, and they had a thick accent. And I can go to New Jersey or some of Philadelphia, the places, nobody thinks at all that I am from Philadelphia or New Jersey when I go there because of the way I talk. You know, I say ka, I say yeah, you know, I say things that Maine say. Imagine, yeah, you know, and so they pick up on that accent. Well, he was from Galilee and they heard his accent. In fact, one of the other gospels tells us it was a relative of the dude whose ear got cut off and said, you look awful familiar to me. I think I saw you recently. And Peter, it says in verse 71, he began to curse and to swear, saying, I know not this man of whom you speak. And it's not that he's just, you know, dropping obscenities. The language says he began to pronounce a curse on himself and swear. And what he said was, if I know him, let me be anathema. Let me be eternally damned. If I even know him, let me go to hell, was the extent of what he said. And right then, verse 72, and the second time, the cock crew. And Peter called to mind the word that Jesus said unto him, before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. And when he thought thereon, he wept. Now Luke gives us a little more information, because what happened was, right in the middle of him denying, saying, if I know him, let me be eternally damned, they led Jesus out of the hall. And it said Jesus looked upon him. And of course, Jesus now is beaten to a pulp, so through a bloodied face, their eyes meet right as he's denying that he ever knew him, and right as he's saying it, and his eyes meet Jesus's, the third one goes off, and it all comes back to his mind. You know, and the question is, what was the look on Jesus's face when their eyes met in the middle of all that? When he was right in the middle of saying, You know, the same guy who with his mouth said, "I'll die with you," is now saying to a little girl, "I let me be damned if I even know him." You think Jesus looked at him and went, "Oh, you wait till I get off this cross"? Or do you think he's got that, you know, that the look you have with your spouse or your brothers and sisters when they blow it, the, "Oh, I can't believe you," you know, that disgust. I don't think that was the look that he had at all, to be honest with you, because he told him ahead of time he was going to do it. He knew that Peter was going to deny him. In fact, he said, "When you're restored, you know, strengthen the brethren." In Peter, here he is, he sees this. In fact, the word that it uses in Luke when it says he looked upon him is the same word that's used when Jesus first met him. And it says he looked upon Peter. And it doesn't mean he just looked at him with his eyes, but actually he perceived him, he knew him, he looked down into him. And that's when he changed his name. And he changed his name from Simon to Peter, Cephas, which means, you know, little rock, rocky. And Jesus knew, when he looked at Peter, he knew Peter, and he knew who he was, and he knew his strengths, and he knew his weaknesses, and he knew what he was going to do. And he's looking at him the same way now, and I don't think it's a look of hate, because I know Jesus, it's not. It's a look of comfort, and it's a look of sadness because of Peter and what Peter is going through. And of course, Peter goes out and it says he weeps bitterly. Later on, when we get to the resurrection story, the angel's going to tell ladies, "Go tell his disciples and Peter that I've risen." And you know Peter's going to be saying, "Did he really say my disciples and Peter? I mean, is he calling me out? Oh, man, I'm done for. When he sees me, I'm toast." But that was not it. I think, if anything, it was because Peter didn't even count himself as a disciple anymore because of his betrayal. But yet the Lord restored him, and the Lord knew, you know. And so we come to the end of this, and I guess my question is for you, first of all, do you know him? Have you asked him, "Are you the one that you say you are?" Because if you haven't asked him to forgive you for your sins, if you haven't taken the payment that he made in your place, then you're right now bound for hell, eternally separated from him. But if you're in that position, you have to realize that it pleased his Father to bruise him for your sake. And that if you were the only person alive at the time when Christ came, he would have died for you. And so I encourage you afterwards, if you don't know the Lord, come see me. I'd be glad to pray with you. And you can start a relationship with him that is like no other. You know, I can tell you this, following the Lord close up, the closer you get to him, the wilder the ride is. And it's a life of adventure, that's for sure. And if you are a believer, but you've been like Peter and you're following him from afar off, you have to realize the same look that he gave Peter is the same look that he has for you. And he's not mad at you. He loves you and he wants to have that relationship restored. You know, when you look at the story of the prodigal son who took off early, grabbed his half of his inheritance, told his dad, "I want my half now and I'm out of here," went off, blew it on prostitutes and getting hammered, and got to the place where he'd wasted everything and he was starving and he was living, working with pigs, and the food that the pigs were eating looked good to him. And he said, "Man, what am I thinking? I got to come to my senses. Even the servants in my father's house eat better than this." And so he goes back and he's got this whole speech in his mind about how he's going to tell his father, "Father, I've sinned against you and against heaven. Please forgive me and let me just be a servant. I don't even deserve to be a son." But if you read that story, the picture of God in that story is the Father. And the Father sees him coming afar off. And before he ever gets there and opens his mouth or recites his little speech about how, "I don't deserve to be your son," it says his Father runs up to him and he kisses him and he puts the ring of sonship on his hand and he puts a robe around him and he welcomes him back. And that's the way your Father is. If you're separated from him, if you've blown it, if you've been spending time away from him, the enemy's fire, he's not mad at you. He's waiting for you to come back. And all he wants to do is forgive you and bring you close again. So let me encourage you, if you are separated from him as we pray, ask him to forgive you. He's just waiting. Let's pray. Lord, every time I read the story of what you did for us, I get blown away because I don't understand why you would. I am so thankful that you did, and I know that more than anything, Lord, that you died for me and my sins. And Lord, I pray if there's anybody here who has been struggling or resisting, Lord, asking you to forgive them, I pray that you would just help them to humble themselves, Lord, and repent. We had to do it. I had to do it, because if I didn't do it, then my sin was still going to be on my account, and there was no way I could pay. Lord, and I pray that you would work in each of our hearts, Lord, to bring us back to you, either if we've never known you, or if we've always lived apart from you, or if we've known you but have drifted away. Lord, help us to just draw close to you, Father, and to get into a relationship where we're tight and personal, and there's no chance of us falling away. There's no way that we're going to run to the enemy's fire. Lord, I pray you would continue to work in us and through us. Lord, you would bless these people. I ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Grace and peace, guys.